Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A month ago, a tent city sprouted in Tel Aviv, Israel. Shades of Tahrir Square and Egypt. The tents are still there in Tel Aviv, and in the weeks since, protesters have been marching across Israel in the hundreds of thousands, singing, shouting, waving signs. It started as a protest over high housing prices, but it's grown to take on a lot more. Israelis are suddenly, in big numbers, in the streets, speaking out against the high cost of living and one of the largest gaps between rich and poor in the industrialized world, calling for a return to the idealism of their country's origins. We always hear about Israelis and Palestinians. This time, it's Israelis talking with themselves. This hour on Point, the big protests in Israel. You can join the conversation. Have you seen the massive outpourings in the street? What's this all about? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Flags and signs in the air in Tel Aviv. Protesters marched 250,000 last week around the country. Here's one man explaining his purpose to Euronews.
We're here today to protest against the high rising cost to live in Israel, against the way the government has forsaken its people in the benefit of the few privileged families.
Here on Thursday, near Barakat, the mayor of Jerusalem was interviewed by Neil Cavuto on Fox News. Mayor Barakat spoke about the demands of the Israeli protesters.
The government accepts what they're saying.
And what are they saying? What do
they
want?
They're basically saying that the middle class in Israel, that is carrying Israel on its back in reserve duty and paying taxes, the life has become a little bit more difficult than people could bear. And they want a different distribution of the burden in the country.
And the protesters come out and come out. Not quite as big this last weekend, but big, big still. Joining me now from Tel Aviv is Itkar Karet, a well-known Israeli author who's been involved with the recent protests in Israel. His latest book is Four Stories. Itkar Karet, welcome back to On Point. It's good to hear from you again.
Hi, Tom. It's nice to be here.
And with us from Concord, New Hampshire, is Bernard Avishai, adjunct professor of business at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, author of the book The Hebrew Republic. He splits his time between Jerusalem and New Hampshire. Bernard Avishai, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you.
Itkar Karet, give us a sense first for those Americans who haven't been there and haven't seen it. What has been going on in the streets of your country in this last month?
Well, it had been a very quick process because just 4 weeks ago, some people called me. They said that they built those tents in one boulevard in Tel Aviv, Rothschild Boulevard, and they asked me to come over and speak to them. And in the beginning, I was very reluctant because it seemed to me that it was a very kind of a narrow struggle about the prices of housing, when I thought that, you know, Israel had bigger problems to deal with. But the moment that I came there, I really saw that there was a very heterogenic group of people. Some of them were young, others were older, some of them were right-wing, others were left-wing. But the one thing that they had in common is that they had this kind of feeling that the government had forsaken them, that they were left behind, that they had an alienated government that really doesn't bring their needs into account. And what interested me much more than their texts, which dealt, you know, with not earning enough money or paying that taxes, was their subtext. And the subtext was really about the fact that they kind of heard stories about a different country, heard stories about a community in which people are responsible for the weaker people in that community. And they kind of want to return to those times. For many of them, they're just kind of a fantasy, a nostalgic thoughts because they never lived in those years.
Let's hear a little more of just what it has sounded like in this past month in the streets of Israel. Here, this was August 6th, over 250,000 Israeli protesters in the streets. This was Tel Aviv, the massive crowd here chanting in Hebrew, "The nation demands social justice." And here in the Tel Aviv tent city, a young Israeli man spoke with the Guardian newspaper about what led him out to protest.
It's almost impossible for me to get a job.
that gets more than minimum wage. As a guy who was just released from the army, I was a combat soldier. I gave my life to this country. I gave 3 years of my life. I was prepared, more than prepared, to die for my country. And it's impossible to live in it. We'll die for this country, but we can't live in it.
And here was a young university student saying she wished the world would give more media coverage to the protest movement in her country.
It makes me upset that when Egypt decided to stand up and say we've had enough, and when in Lebanon they decided to say we've had enough, the media was all over there. I haven't seen anyone from CNN or from Fox News or any other, you know, big news channel here, and it's really sad. We also deserve a chance to be heard out.
Edgar Caret joins us from Tel Aviv. Bernard Arvashai is with us as well. Bernard, what do you see going on in these protests in Israel?
Well, first of all, it's true that it's easy to bring people out when there are great inequalities in the country, but I really think we're also talking about the opportunity cost of maintaining an occupation and maintaining a world which is not really as rich as the country should be. I mean, you know, it's hard to speak about inequalities because Israel is actually a kind of Silicon Valley. And when you have 40-50% of your exports going in software, pharmaceuticals, high value-added components, it's natural that those companies that sell to the world that way are going to hit the jackpot. I've had two sets of students, each of whom formed companies and sold them for $20 million, one to Google, one to Getty Images. Now, I will work all my life and not make that kind of money. So inequalities in of themselves don't mean that life is bad. The problem is that the vast majority of people are working in jobs and working for paychecks where they can't finish the month. And the problem is not that there are some people who are very rich. The problem is that on the whole, the country isn't nearly as rich as it could be.
And you're tying that all the way back to occupation of the West Bank and that whole giant issue in Israel. Let us put a pause on that for just a moment, and we will definitely come to it. But Edgar Caret, what about this cost of living complaint just for beginners? I mean, we've heard a lot of people talking about housing, a lot of people talking about cottage cheese. What's going on with that?
Well, first of all, I want to say that I agree with Bernard Avishai that the occupation is a major player, first of all, in the situation and also in the nature of the protest, because there's something about this protest that most protests in the world, and for sure protests in Israel, were all about kind of dichotomizing the society. It was always political, and when, let's say, people were against occupations, there was a big group that was for occupation. What you really feel in this protest is that there is a very naive attempt that is partially successful to kind of unify people through protest. You really feel that in the story that they're telling, first of all, if you go to the demonstrations, you feel that people are almost, most of the time, are arguing who is the bad guy. Many people hold signs against occupation. Some hold signs against Netanyahu. Other hold signs against not respecting pensioners, you know. But the agenda is very, very open. But I think that in the recent years, a political demonstrations that dealt with left-wing issues as the occupation couldn't bring over 3,000 people. And then suddenly you have something that brings over 300,000 people. And I think that the big difference here is that everybody who goes to the street feels that the entire country is in the street. You know, it's almost as if we're looking for something in common, because a country that had a socialist backbone and kind of lost it to a very wide alienating kind of capitalism, you see all those people that, except for being afraid of Palestinians, Lebanese, Syrian, or whoever could attack us, they really don't see what they have in common. And this demonstration gives them a chance to occupy the same space, to share something, to be able to have a direct dialogue. You know, Israel, very much like the U.S., people kind of go to their home, see commercial TV. You know, if they want to be involved, they send a text message for the guys that they like in American Idol. But the idea of having a real community and having and feeling a part of something bigger is, I think, what this demonstration is all about. So, it, you know, people can talk about the cost of living, but it's a major issue. But in the bottom line, I think that what brought people to the street with such passion is much more than a narrow economical issue.
Bernard Avishai, something bigger than the cost of living here, but what? I mean, Israel has very different threads of political view. Is it really an agenda against occupation? Is it really a peace agenda? Or is this just a middle class that's feeling pressed?
Yeah, I'm not implying that everyone in the streets has connected the dots yet. I leave it to young leaders who are going to be evolving over time to do that for them. But I do think that the bigger issue is that these young people want to be part of the world too. I mean, Edgar speaks about alienating capitalism. Well, that's true to a point. But it's a kind of global capitalism, which has actually brought a lot of these young people into very cosmopolitan attitudes. And a lot of the companies that are doing well and that they want to work for are very insinuated into global markets and connect them up to the rest of the world. You know, we'll come back to that.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the huge month of protests in Israel. Hundreds of thousands in the streets, tent city in Tel Aviv, the works, Israelis calling for an end to the status quo, an end to growing inequality. Edgar Karet joins us from Tel Aviv, very well-known author in Israel. He's been active in these protests. His most recent book is Four Stories. Bernard Avishai joins us from Concord, New Hampshire, author of The Hebrew Republic, How Secular Democracy and Global Enterprise Will Bring Israel Peace at Last. He divides his time between New Hampshire and Jerusalem. You can join the conversation as well at 800-423-8255. Bernard, do us a favor, if you would, just give us a little history lesson for people who don't really know about the economic story in Israel. As Edgar says, Israel did have a lot of state-owned enterprise, a lot of more socialist structure until the 1980s. Today I'm looking here at reports from the Bank of Israel saying that it's got inequality much higher than that in the United States, in Britain, in Germany. What happened over these years? One thing, as you describe, is this burst of high-tech industry and fortunes made. But what about there's been a lot of attention to the so-called tycoons, the big Israeli families who dominate so much the Israeli economy.
Right. Well, first of all, again, remember inequality in itself doesn't mean poverty. In Silicon Valley, there are a lot of very, very rich people, but generally speaking, people aren't marching in the streets. You have to look at what's happening to the middle class itself. Something like 60% of Israelis now earn less than $22,000 a year. Let's say you earn 30. Well, your budget is going to be split between a third going to taxes, a third going to housing, and a third going to consumer durables of all kinds, or cottage cheese for that matter. Leave the housing and the taxes alone for a second. Just look at the last part, because that's where the so-called tycoons and monopolists are most visible, and they're the easiest target. In the last 15 years, there's been a tremendous concentration of wealth. Something like the 20 largest families, richest families, own something like 20% of the 500 largest companies They've been enjoying monopolistic pricing because the government has been very happy to put tariffs on certain kinds of things that might have been actually lowering the cost of living. Dairy products. It's very hard to get into the cell phone market, very hard to get into banking and so on. By the way, the fact that it was very hard to get into banking actually saved Israel during the economic meltdown because the banks were very highly regulated and you didn't have international competition bringing Israel to a kind of Iceland situation.
Mm-hmm.
It's very frustrating for people to feel that they're paying more for cottage cheese in Israel than they would if they were shopping in Berlin. So that's one part of their world, which is frustrating them. The other is housing, of course. You can look for a lot of reasons why the cost of housing is very high. The most important reason is that the government... By the way, this is a residual part of the socialist past. The government mm-hmm. controls or owns 90% of the land in Israel and releases the land only in very small increments, often to contractors who are tied to the government. However, I think this is very important to say because a lot of people in the streets aren't really letting this in. When you look back at the socialist past, it was really a kind of, and I'm using the term advisedly, it was a kind of national socialist past. I mean, the land was meant to be used to develop neighborhoods exclusively for Jews for the most part. And the great fear of privatizing land in Israel is that Arabs will be able to acquire much more land for the development of their own parts of the country.
Arab Israelis.
Mm-hmm. Arab Israelis, who are 20% and soon going to be 25% of the mm-hmm. population. Mm-hmm. So Israelis are in a kind of crisis of denial about this. A lot of the people in the streets who are not connecting the dots are not willing really to understand that if you really want to have an egalitarian democratic movement, you have to include Arabs in the mix. The Arabs are the most disadvantaged part of the Israeli population. And the cost of housing would, in fact, be brought down, but only in ways that would actually empower a great many more Arabs to acquire land, sort of like Dudi Kravitz did in Montreal.
Mm-hmm. Edgar Caret in Tel Aviv. Here I'm reading from the Jerusalem Post, where conservative columnist Martin Sherman is writing, saying that the political left is out of steam in Israel, not much steam in the peace process. And he writes, the left-leaning opposition is looking desperately for a new card to play, their unlikely, inappropriate, and outdated choice, social justice. He's describing these protests as the left trying to, you know, put forward a kind of Trojan horse of a new agenda when they don't have enough support for their core agenda.
Well, first of all, I want to say that the Israeli Arabs are integrated in this struggle. I've worked in the demonstrations and I've met quite a few of them. And last weekend, the demonstrations, some of them were in mixed cities, and the attendance by Israeli Arabs was surprisingly better than mm-hmm. what was accepted.
Which is great.
Which is great, but what I want to say is that there are so many people in Israel that they are so detached from the streets and the way that people live that they actually live in some sort of a parallel universe. I don't know how much you make if you write a column for Jerusalem Post, but I can tell you that a vast majority in Israel work sometimes in more than one job and find it very difficult to earn a living. In Israel, Netanyahu put a lot more burden on the indirect tax. You know, you pay VAT for water. So mm-hmm. when you pay VAT for mm-hmm. water, then of course the people who would suffer from it the most won't be tycoons, but the families that have a lot of children. You know, the VAT is incredibly high. There are all kinds of indirect taxes on fuel. You know, when you need to take a car to drive your kids to school, then you pay that, you know, and regardless of how much you make. And at the same time, Netanyahu had lowered the direct taxes. So it means that if you earn a lot or if you have a company, you pay less tax. And this structure is a structure that strangles a big part of the community. But again, I think that there is something very very mixed in it. I think that what's amazing about Netanyahu's government is that it was able to get so many people angry and to feel that, to make so many people feel unrepresented, that if you're not a settler or an ultra-Orthodox, then basically you look at his government and you say, who is there that represents me? And usually, you know, when you have this kind of demonstration, the person who go to the street are the poorest. In Israel, it is the middle class that feels that is completely transparent, that it's not taken into account in anybody's plan.
Bernard, we're going to go in just a moment to a settler in the West Bank for that view. But Edgar mentioned settlers and the ultra-Orthodox. Supporting settlers and special arrangements for the ultra-Orthodox in Israel are also expensive. And I'm reading here in the news reports have been part of what's been protested in the streets as well. Explain that issue to us.
Well, first of all, Israel has something like 56% of its adult population working. That's about 12 to 15% lower than the best OECD countries. And that's partly the result, largely the result, of the support of ultra-Orthodox yeshivot and settlers.
I don't understand that. Why does support of the ultra-Orthodox mean people aren't working? They're being supported
because they're
not
working.
Why not?
Because they're being paid not to work. They're being paid to study. They're basically being
yeshiva.
Paid to
mm-hmm.
study
okay.
endlessly.
Mm-hmm.
Or getting jobs, managing the kashrut of various restaurants or something like that. They're not really doing productive labor. But just to strengthen what Edgar was saying a moment ago, because of this tremendous burden on the national budget, healthcare has lost something like 40% of its subsidy over the last 10 years. And these are during times when Netanyahu was either prime minister or finance minister. Rent assistance was cut in half in 2003 when he was finance minister and has lost another 30% since then. So when you look at these bread and butter issues, Netanyahu has been implicated in cutting the social services budgets in order to balance the budget while he's been expanding settlements and expanding subsidies for people who aren't working. This is a terrible burden on young middle class people like that kid you interviewed who said, you know, I got out of the army, I was prepared to live to die for the country, but I can't live in it. So this is a problem. But again, think about the opportunity cost. You look at healthcare. Israel has the best hospitals in the Middle East, some of the best in the world. Overnight, Israeli healthcare could be transformed, revolutionized by medical tourism for those people in the region coming from the Gulf who want medical care. But they can't get it because on top of the way in which Netanyahu is skewing the budget, he's maintaining a kind of stance vis-a-vis the region, which is making it impossible for these kinds of, you know, economic gains. And I think more and more it's starting to filter in that Israel could be a far wealthier, that is, a far happier and more peaceful place than it is.
Bernard Avishai, Edgar Caret, please stand by. Joining us right now from Jerusalem is Nadia Matar. She lives in the West Bank as a settler there, political activist, founder of the Israeli settlers group Women in Green. It supports Israeli settlement of land captured in the 1967 war, opposes the creation of a Palestinian state. Nadia Matar, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome. We call ourselves the inheritors. The settlers is a very pejorative word. The translation of the Hebrew word is inheritors. We came back and liberated our biblical homeland. How are you?
Very well. What do you see being expressed in these very large protests in the streets of Israel, Nadia?
So before I tell about the differences between us and me and the speakers before us, I want to mention just very briefly something that unites all Israelis, extreme left to the national right, settlers, religious or not religious, is the demand by the Israeli people to free Jonathan Pollard now and are outraged at the fact that he did not get medical care after his operation. And we expect the American people to ask and demand from President Obama to free Jonathan Pollard now.
You're talking about the guy who was convicted of leaking secrets?
Of giving information that the Americans were
to Israel.
Supposed to give Israel and unfortunately didn't. And he was forced to in order to save us from nuclear attack. And we thank him for that.
Take us
now
to the protest.
Now we go on to your question.
Mm-hmm.
What the previous speakers did not say is that not Bibi Netanyahu has to be blamed for the situation. And by the way, the demonstrations that are taking place are certainly focusing on a real issue. I have myself a daughter who's going to get married and has nowhere to live because there's a problem in housing and prices, etc. But what they did not mention is that a main and fundamental reason for this situation is that some 17 years ago, the Oslo agreements were signed, the infamous agreements in which we unfortunately gave up large parts of Judea and Samaria, what you like to call the West Bank, we call the Israel's biblical heartland, Judea and Samaria. Jews were not allowed to build anymore. As you know, we live in the freeze. And Jews in Judea and Samaria, unlike the Arabs who built everywhere freely with no problem, Jews cannot build. And therefore, when we turn to those demonstrators who organize the demonstrations, unfortunately, the leaders of those demonstrations are people known to be extreme leftists with an agenda to bring down Bibi Netanyahu. We tell them, instead of calling for the downfall of Bibi Netanyahu, the answer to the indeed existing problem of housing is to apply Israeli sovereignty over Judea and Samaria and start building tens of thousands of houses 10 minutes away from Jerusalem, 20 minutes away by car from Kfar Saba and Tel Aviv.
What about the Palestinians? What about the Palestinians? What about the
Palestinians? They have no problem. They build with no problem.
No, but they seem to have a problem with Israeli building there.
The Palestinians, the Arabs in Judea and Samaria, live the best lives the Arabs can live ever. The Arabs in Syria, the Arabs in Egypt are longing to come, God forbid, and to come to Judea and Samaria where the Arabs have a wonderful life. They have villas. They are funded by you guys, by your tax money, by the European Union.
Yeah.
They get billions of dollars.
But we've seen a lot of images. Nadia, let me ask you, here's a comment on our website, Nadia, from a listener who's listening to the show right now. And he writes, this is Alan, writes, end the occupation. Israel cannot afford it.
I agree. We should end the Arab occupation of Bethlehem and of Hebron, and we should reinstall and apply Israeli sovereignty over what is our biblical homeland, the same way you guys would never give up on New York and Manhattan and give it to Bin Laden's friends. We will not give up our biblical homeland to Abu Mazen and other terrorists who all they want is to, as they have their slogans in Hebrew, first the Saturday people, then the Sunday people, first let's get rid of Israel, and then let's get rid of Europe, turn it into Eurabia, and go on to New York. You don't understand what
you're
saying.
Nadia, let me take this to Tel Aviv for a moment, if I may. Edgar Caret, what do you say to this perspective, and how does it intersect or not with the people in the streets in Tel Aviv?
Well, actually, I feel that that a lot of the budgets that are being put into the territories, budgets, first of all for construction, but also for guarding very small communities with army bases, is the money that can be used for education and building inside the 67 line. Statistics say that that the government had subsidized and sponsored building in the occupied territories in three times as much as it did the same inside the 67 border. It is a political thing. And I think that, that the settlers have a big problem because in the past, the settlers were the only organized communities that knew how to go out to the street. The middle class, we sat in our living rooms and we cursed. And suddenly, when you see another pressure group, a much bigger one, it's not even a pressure group, it's the country going to the street and said, we had enough, I think it threatens the settlers because they had this unique position. I don't know the exact number, but I would say it would be 300,000 or under that are the entire settler community. And suddenly you have the same number of people coming to one square in Israel and saying, we had enough. So, of course, I would be stressed if I would be in Nadia's shoes.
Yeah, Nadia, we just have a few seconds. Do you think these protests will change Israeli policy against the interests of those in the West Bank?
If that would be true, that would be against the interests of the Jews living in Tel Aviv, because if, God forbid, a state of Palestine is created, the first target will be of the bombs of the Arabs will be on Tel Aviv. And the person who spoke before, I'm asking him, we are 750,000 settlers. If we all move now to Tel Aviv, don't you think there would be a housing project? You want me to stay in Judea and Samaria and guard you and protect you from terrorist attacks that would, God forbid, attack you.
Nadia Matar of Women in Green, joining us today from Jerusalem. Thank you very much for being with us. Edgar Caret, Bernard Avishai, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the huge month of protests in Israel. Israelis in the streets calling for an end to the status quo, an end to growing inequality. Here were protesters chanting, singing, cheering this weekend in the streets of Haifa. Hundreds of thousands out over the last month in Israel. Israelis, what is this all about? What is going on in the streets of your country? We've been joined by Bernard Avishai, author of The Hebrew Republic, adjunct professor of business at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and Edgar Caret, Israeli author, terrific writer. His most recent book is Four Stories, joining us from Tel Aviv. He's been in the streets as well. Let's hear from our listeners. Salem, Massachusetts, Laura's calling. Hi, Laura, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I live in Israel, in Jerusalem. I've lived there for 34 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, talk to Edgar Caret and to Bernard Avishai.
Mm-hmm.
I really feel that this is a protest of the middle classes. This is our way of saying that we cannot put up with growing social inequality, income inequality, growing inequalities in education, health, the periphery versus the center of the country. And I think that a sign of a healthy society is a healthy middle class. And we want a place where our children will want to live and will continue to live. And that's what I hope and feel this is really about. It's also a problem of representational government, which we do not truly have in Israel. We have no our elected officials are not responsible to a constituency as such. They're only responsible to their party. So we have no other way of showing our dissatisfaction with the way Israeli society is going.
Laura, let me ask you, Edgar Caret and Bernard extend that argument to peace and the Palestinians and say, look, there's an opportunity cost there in the settlements. What do you think about that?
I think that that is always an issue. It's always a subtext, the peace issue. But I think that for a change, Israelis are looking inwards and saying, what kind of society do we ultimately want to have? Where our children will want to live, where there are great opportunities for everyone, for a vibrant middle class, for us sushi eaters. Yes, I want to eat sushi.
And what about Nadia? Nadia, you just heard her saying, the answer here is to build more houses in the occupied territories.
I'm afraid that she's trying to hijack the issue here, which is the middle class and social inequalities.
Laura, I appreciate your call very much, Laura. Bernard, I hear you there.
Yeah, I just want to say, there are there aren't many inequalities in Romania, but they're not eating sushi in Romania.
Well, they might be, I don't know.
The problem is not just equality, inequality. It's how you create wealth. And Israel can't avoid some of the problems that we have in, New Hampshire or elsewhere in the world. There is a large middle class that has to get with the kinds of competitive forces that exist in the global economy, which some, in fact, many Israeli companies have proven terrifically good at. But there is going to be a big middle class that don't have the skills and don't have the cool to participate in the global economy like the people living not far from where Edgar lives in Tel Aviv. And here, again, peace is a really important consideration because when the Palestinians start building their state, they're going to need one of everything. And they're going to be attracting a tremendous amount of investment in construction, in tourism, in food processing, in the development of easy pharmaceuticals.
Nadia says they're just going to be dropping bombs on you.
These are the industries that Israel's middle class are going to be part of a business ecosystem and building with them.
But let me ask you if I may, Bernard, because you heard Nadia Matar said, no, what they're going to be doing is attacking you in Tel Aviv, sending rockets over at you. Now, we hear a lot of that kind of a fear in U.S. conversations as well. What about that?
I go to Ramallah once a month. I have friends in Ramallah. I'm working to help develop a Palestine Institute of Management. I know, you know, I have many, many friends in Ramallah. Obviously, they have their radicals like we have our Nadia. You know, people say Tel Aviv people live in a bubble. You know, Nadia lives in a bubble, and she's been dragging the rest of the country into that bubble for a long, long time. I think this is a huge resistance movement to the kind of bubble that people like Nadia are trying to bring Israel into.
Blanche in Corinth, Vermont. Blanche, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Listen to you daily and love the way you question people's statements.
Privileged to do it.
I have visited, about 10 years ago, I visited Israel. My question now is, what percentage of their, what we call federal budget, goes to the military and the cost of building these new settlements that they're doing for the Jewish community?
We'll pick it up. Edgar, I'll bring that to you. But Bernard, perhaps first you hear the question. I'm not sure how you want to frame the response, but you...
Well, just numbers before Edgar speaks. I'm sure he knows the numbers too by now. But let me just say, the defense budget in Israel is about 18% of the budget.
How does that compare with other nations?
Huge. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean...
With the U.S.?
America is like... The U.S. is what, 6-7%?
Okay.
But, you know, that's 6-7% of a much different economy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in Israel, the military budget is about a fifth, a sixth of a budget, which is huge in the country. The cost of the occupation is huge. The amount of money spent on settlements just on the infrastructure is about $20 billion. As not per year, of course, but $20 billion on infrastructure. That doesn't count the cost of keeping the settlements going, defending them, putting in electricity, educating, and so on. So the cost of the occupation is enormous, let alone the opportunity cost of not developing the economy along with the Palestinians.
Edgar, what do you think? Are you developing a real political change in the streets, or is this just an expression of frustration? Benjamin Netanyahu has been strong in his coalition there. Do you think you'll change Israel with these protests?
The truth is, you know, I can't predict what's going to happen in the short run. And there is a good chance that this struggle and protest will end in failure. I'm quite aware of that. But I think in the long run, it will change the discourse in the Israeli society. I think that the idea was that we were brought up in a system saying, you know, that the moment that you go outside and protest against your government, you're like a fifth column, you're working against your country. And now something there was broken. And this idea of a totally alienated a representative who really don't listen to the people, and don't represent big groups, I think this is going to disappear. I think that this protest will end with new kinds of leadership in the politics. It will bring some fear that politicians in Israel had long lost. And this, we will see its fruit, I think, only a few more years from now.
Is there a longing for the past here, Edgar? I think a lot of Americans, even today, when they think of Israel, they think all the way back to Israel's early days and the kibbutz and the kind of very egalitarian society. Is there a longing for the past in the streets?
I think that there are many nostalgic thoughts. I think that, you know, a lot of those nostalgic sentiments are not completely true if you check them factually. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, that the change in Israel in 77 came because the socialist system didn't work well. It discriminated some of the citizens from the others, and people wanted a change. But still, I really feel that the Israeli kind of know things that from the past that Americans never had. You know, the fact that when I see my kid growing up and I start considering sending him to a private school because I know that the public schools are getting worse and worse by the year, it's something that is against my upbringing, you know, because it's an upbringing for some sort of equality. So it's not that I miss the 60s, but I think that we can, that instead of kind of taking one system, throwing it into the garbage and exchanging it with a system that I actually feel is worse, I think that we can take a lot of the good stuff that we had in our past and reunite it with many other things that actually work in the contemporary system.
Tom Friedman writes in the New York Times, Israel's now dominated by an oligopoly of crony capitalists. David in Bluffton, South Carolina. David, you're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call, and I applaud you for putting this on the air, because Americans really do need to be more aware of the facts on the ground and what's happening. I've been to Israel over a dozen times, and I've just completed a book. I won't mention the title simply because I'm not calling to promote my book, but it is about Israel and Palestine and peace, and I've been to Ramallah. A man mentioned that earlier, and I've had a wonderful experience in the last 20 years completing my book.
So what do you think is happening here, David? What do you see unfolding?
Well, there's an awful lot of exciting things that are happening, and there's also a lot of troubling things that are happening, but I believe that let's call it the Arab Spring, and the world is more aware of that, and that has caused an awakening, and I think the new thing that's going to be coming out, hopefully, is the revolution now, which is about a year away, but Israel is going to come to terms with what's going on, and I believe that there will be a nation state for Palestine sooner than most people think. You're probably aware that on September the 22nd, the United Nations Security Council is going to declare Palestine a nation state. But back to the Israeli issue that you were mentioning, and although, you know, a lot of people have covered a whole lot of different issues, I think simply the whole thing can be boiled down to about five issues, and they're not, any of them are not that difficult. It deals with border rights, it deals with water, it deals with the right of return to the refugees, and it deals with the 1967 line. President Obama has already said that we have to come back to that line, and it's very simple. In 1948, Israel was supposed to get, depending on your figures, 49-51%. It's known as the Green Line today. They went past that, and they took another, by the end of 48, they had 78%. Well,
David, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. In the U.N., I think it's the General Assembly vote coming up here, and that has got a lot of attention in Israel. Security Council may well, if the General Assembly votes for Palestinian statehood, you may see an American veto in the Security Council. But, Bernard, that has certainly got a lot of Israelis' attention, certainly Netanyahu government's attention, and raising the stakes and the pressure here, Bernard.
Yes. Let's park for a moment the question of what happens at the UN. But I think the question you raised for Edgar, which is, are people nostalgic about a past, is really relevant to this question, because I think we have to hope that people are nostalgic for the future. You know, I think we need a little bit of nostalgia for the future here. And the future is going to depend tremendously on how the leadership of this young movement deals with the fact that there are Arabs involved in its coalition.
Is that a problem?
Absolutely not. That's their hope. That's the hope. That's the future we have to be nostalgic for. Mm-hmm. There will never be a progressive middle class in Israel that ever wins an election again that is not going to have a huge proportion of Arabs as part of it. And we have to start, you know, redefining what the people means. I mean, when Edgar and I were on your program 2-3 years ago talking about the Hebrew Republic, it's because that's now, I think, a very important piece of how we have to look at the future. We have to define the people as that which is inclusive of people who aren't necessarily Jews, but are part of an Israeliness, an Israeli reality that is connected to the rest of the world, that's a Hebrew-speaking version of this global thing, and have to become spacious enough in their view of what it means to have an Israeli people to include Arabs in it. If Arabs are not part of this coalition, if we do revert back to the past, if we revert back to the world of 1958 when Arabs were just kind of quaint things on the landscape, we're going to be sunk, and this movement will sink. And I think this movement is the best hope against something that's really quite terrifying.
Jeremy in Willimantic, Connecticut. Jeremy, you're on the air.
Excuse me, can I comment on
Edgar,
that?
Of course, please, Edgar, please.
Yeah, I just want to say that, you know, that the protesters, they have a special team that deals with the issues that they want to negotiate. And one of the people in this team is actually an expert to the Israeli-Arab needs. And I've just heard her today, and she spoke a lot about how the Arab population is the one that really gets the short end of the stick and how this has to change. So I actually think that it's already a part of the agenda.
Jeremy, sorry there. You're on, Jeremy.
So my interest in this is, besides because of a real connection to Israel, I'm a rabbi, I've been there. Many times, spent a lot of time there, but also an American connection. I feel like the Israeli middle class has woken up to the fact that that a government of greed is actually not good for them, and I feel like the American middle class hasn't quite woken up to that. We feel like a government that says, "Yeah, be rich, everyone for themselves," you know, give as much as possible to the richest, is somehow going to help us. And I think we need to learn from the Israelis. So that's As American as opposed to Jew, that's what really excites me about this.
Jeremy, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Edgar, do you feel, people are calling this the Israeli summer after the Arab Spring, do you feel some shared dynamic, some shared theme with the big crowds that were in Cairo at Tahrir Square? Is there something related here or entirely different?
I think that there is a relation, but of course the situation is different because, you know, those people were living in a dictatorship, and we can complain as much as we want about our elected officials, but we elect them. And I wanted to say about what Jeremy was just referring to is that Netanyahu is a great fan of the American system. And the truth is that the American system has a lot that you can admire about it. But actually, the advantage that you have when you imitate another system is that you can see how processes are going to end. And actually, economically, America has just reached a very problematic period in its life, where the ideas of, let's say, not intervening in the economical markets or in other markets created quite a lot of problems. So I think that it would just make sense that Netanyahu, who wants to be like the U.S., would have this a glimpse of the future and would understand that maybe he needs an improved system, not just imitate a system that right now seems to be failing.
A lot of Israelis saying no in the streets of Israel recently to good chunks of what they're looking at there, and maybe yes to a new future, as Bernard Avishai describes it. Edgar Caret, it is always wonderful to speak with you, author most recently of four stories, joining us today from Tel Aviv. Thank you so much for being with us, Edgar.
Thank you, Tom.
And Bernard Avishai, author of The Hebrew Republic. Thanks very much for being with us today, Bernard.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.